She pretended you were me.
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are streaming live at freakradio.org. Now, if you want to hear us on your computer, you need to click on the red oval you see towards the bottom of the main page. That'll give you the free streaming link to our online radio service. Also, for those who are pretty much within the city limits of Santa Cruz, California, you can hear us on the FM dial at 101.3. Shut up, Stuart. For now, anyway. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, and you're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, April 5, Cinco de Mayo. Gotta stick that little plug in there. In the year of the Common Era 2014, I am Ren Tawil, host for a little less than the next 2 hours. I expect us to be joined in perpetuity of the length of this program by a special guest, and I'm going to call him right now. I spoke with him a few minutes ago, so he's alive and well. Hello.
Hello, Ren.
Okay, David, now your voice, I hate to be so nitpicky, but now it's blaring a little bit and somewhat distorted. Do you think you can fix that? Maybe back away from the microphone a little bit, or...
Okay, how about this?
Okay, now you're understandable. Oh, right. I think we're ready to just go ahead and do this. To my listening audience out there, for this Mideast Migraine Show, Monday, May the 5th, I have a special guest, Mr. David James Vickery. He is speaking to us from, how do you pronounce the name of the town, David?
Terradent.
Terradent, Morocco. That's the country of Morocco in northwest Africa. This is, everyone keep your fingers crossed here, this is the interview that between the two of us, we failed to successfully bring you on two separate recent occasions. So we're just going to do this now. Let me tell you a little bit about Mr. Vickery. Here's the short story. I have been reading on air on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines a book by a man named Max Blumenthal, who is an American, East Coast American Jewish man. The book is entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And I just finished the readings, which began last November, reading on average about 3 chapters per week, per episode. Just 2 days ago, I finished reading Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And a few weeks ago, I received a call from a Mr. Pat Kittle, a resident of Santa Cruz. He called to congratulate me. He called me at the station here during a station break, congratulating me for reading the book on the air like that. He already owned a copy and had given it out to 1 or 2 people, and so he had read it, and he just wanted to be provide encouragement to me for reading it. And in the course of that conversation, Pat Kittle, and it's okay for me to use his name, I have his verbal permission. Pat said, he told me about what was going on the Amazon website, where, of course, Amazon.com, they sell a lot of books, and Blumenthal's Goliath is one of them. And generally, there is a comment section for books that are being sold by the website, and this one is as hot and heavy as any of the ones on Amazon. The first 2 comments alone had generated literally hundreds, going into the 500, 600, or 700 of comments of people going back and forth about the goodness of Israel, and back again with the evilness of Israel. And, you know, I have seen so many of these kinds of listener comment sections that it, quite frankly, gets really tedious, the back and forthness of it. But he, Mr. Kittle, is the one who introduced me to the fact that there are, as he referred to them, trolls. In this case, pro-Israel camp trolls who deliberately go onto these websites for the exclusive purpose of bashing a book which gives any support to the opposition, any support to the Palestinians, or to Palestinian solidarity. According to Kittle, this is what the trolls do. And I acknowledged his call, thanked him. We went back to doing the reading, and a couple of weeks later, lo and behold, I came across that very part in the book that I was reading, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, where Blumenthal talks about the phenomenon of trolls, and even revealed in that particular part of the chapter that I was reading that some of them are paid as much as $2,000 to in exchange for their dutifully going on to these websites and comment sections and committing what he referred to as hasbara. Hasbara is the Hebrew word for, to put most simply, to explain. Hasbara, to explain. But put more realistic, relevant, contemporary terms, hasbara in this context is to provide propaganda or spin in favor of Israel and in efforts to dismiss anything that goes against the Israeli line. There was hasbara aplenty when I latched on to Amazon's comments of Mr. Blumenthal's book. And, you know, eventually I got into the inevitable hot and heaviness of it, as tedious as it got to be. I've been doing this for years. You know, chat rooms, message rooms, message boards, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly done my best to inform the public, you know, my own explanations. I don't know what the Arabic equivalent word for that is. Maybe David knows it. But the thing is, very shortly after I began reading these not only the reviews from readers, but comments directed to those reviews, but David Vickery wrote a response, one of the first, I think it was the very first response to my review of the book, saying, I don't have it in front of me, but basically it said, "Wow, that's great that you're actually reading the book on your radio show." And that's how I met Mr. Vickery, and we conversed through the Amazon Book Reviews website, and I, in short order, I discovered Mr. Vickery and I are very much of like mind. He very deftly and adeptly addressed even the most negative, sometimes utterly bitter, incisive criticisms that pro-Israeli people had of Blumenthal in his book and David's comments and my comments. And I've come to admire Mr. Vickery, never having met the man, but just through his writings. David Vickery, welcome to the program. Welcome to Mideast Migraines. What do you say?
Thank you. Anyone who wants to go to Amazon.com for the book Goliath, check the reviews. Mine is one of the earliest 5-star reviews. It's entitled Nothing But the Truth. And that got many, many comments, and comments on comments.
So, David, you are correct me if I'm wrong, a born and bred Canadian?
Oh, yes, I was born in Canada. I'm 70 years old. Would you like to start with... What took me to the Middle East?
That's exactly what I was getting at. Please do. Go ahead. The floor is yours.
Okay. I have a pretty good idea how I want to structure it. It was December the 6th. I remember it was December 6th of 2000. Someone sent me an email, a link to an article on IndyMedia, the IndyMedia website. An Israeli woman actually posted an invitation to internationals, foreigners, to come and join a march in support of Palestinians during Ramadan, marching from the Bethlehem area to the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan to pray at the mosque.
Now, okay. You were still in Canada at this point in time. Is that correct?
I was still, at that time I was living in Hamilton, Ontario.
Okay.
In Canada.
Okay,
yes.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I received that email. I can't even remember who it was that sent it to me, but that was the 6th. By the 13th, I had gotten a new passport, bought a plane ticket, and... by the 14th, I was in East Jerusalem, staying at the Faisal Hostel. And to tell you the truth, I had never been across the Atlantic in my life. Mm-hmm. The furthest from Canada I had ever been, I went to Cuba one time for 2 weeks. But
that sounds exciting.
Yeah, it was really something. I had 2 weeks before I was to return to Canada, but... okay, and so what happened with the march I was supposed to, that I went to participate in, and I did very quickly. I met the person who posted that invitation, and she's still my friend. She's an Israeli woman who has been married for years to a Palestinian man. They have 3 children. A very happy marriage. Very good marriage.
What can anyway, you tell us? Can you tell us their names, David? What was her name and her husband's name?
I don't think I want to give you their names.
All right, go. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. So I'm there in East Jerusalem, and the event, which was to take place on the 15th of December, ended up being canceled because the Israeli border guards killed a Palestinian man. They shot and killed. And so they were afraid to continue with the march. And the next thing that stands out of my memory was spending Christmas Eve in Bethlehem. And, you know, I had been staying at a hostel in East Jerusalem. But, you know, at the time, everything was absolutely new to me. Everything, absolute. Mm-hmm. So I was in Bethlehem, and that is just the most memorable, very, very special time, Christmas Eve 2000. Anyway,
Okay.
What after 2 weeks there, I could not bring myself to simply go back to Canada. What was happening, what I was observing, I'm right there across from Damascus Gate, the old city of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. I was witnessing native Palestinians being attacked by Israeli security police on horseback. I saw, you know, a man being beaten over the head with a billy club. It was horrendous. I helped women with their children crossing the street. It's one of the things I did. But it was just such a learning experience that I just let that plane go back without me. You know, 2 weeks later, I just didn't go back.
Okay.
I went to Nablus. Went to during those times it was pretty easy to travel from Jerusalem to Nablus. I went and I'm standing outside the police station, and I'm looking for volunteer work somewhere. I had no clue what I wanted to do, but I knew I needed to be doing something.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm standing inside the police station and reading one of the posters there and copying down some telephone numbers. And in no time, I'm surrounded by Palestinian police wanting to know what I wanted and what I was doing there. And I communicated to them that I'm looking for volunteer work. Well, to cut a long story short, I think I even met the mayor of Nablus mm-hmm. at one point, but I eventually was accepted to work at the university, Najah National University.
David, I think if I can interrupt, you are sounding
yes.
pretty good, but because I'm not sure of how this is going to come out over the air or on the recording, I think you probably should try to speak a little louder. That's all. Just can you speak up, please?
Okay, I will.
Okay.
I will.
Good.
Okay, so I had an interview. I'm cutting a long story very short.
Mm-hmm.
I had an interview and I was accepted to work at the university in the public relations department. Okay. So I had my own desk, my own computer, and I worked for, I did so many different things. We did the entire university course calendar in English for the first time ever. I worked in collaboration with one of the English teachers. Okay, so this is in the spring of 2001, by this time.
Okay.
I'm in Nablus in April of 2001, and I'm living in an apartment with professors from the university. Okay. Eventually, slowly and gradually, it became more and more difficult. It became more and more difficult for these professors and instructors to get home to their families. Many of them lived outside of the city in villages because of the checkpoints, because they could maybe get home, but then they couldn't get back to work. So more and more of these men were staying in apartments provided by the university. So my situation where I started out having my own room in a three-bedroom apartment, we ended up with 11 people living in that apartment with the living room full of beds, okay? So situation was deteriorating, and I eventually had to leave there. This was after about a year.
Now,
and I moved in with a friend. Huh?
Which yes? situation? Tell us more about the situation that was deteriorating. What are you referring to?
Okay, there were many little invasions of the army coming into the city and, you know, shooting their guns and, you know, people running to their homes. It became commonplace.
And this was in Nablus, okay? Nablus in 2001, is that right?
Yeah, 2001 in Nablus.
Okay.
Yeah, so over a long period of time, it became more and more difficult also for students to come to school, you know, if they were living in villages outside of the city. So, you know, the tension just gradually, slowly increased. So it was after about a year I moved out and I moved in with a friend who was a student at the university, but also a policeman. I meet the most interesting people. Mm-hmm. And luckily, and lucky for me, that people were by and large quite fluent in English. Mm-hmm. So I'd really, although at the university I had the opportunity to take Arabic classes, I really didn't speak there because I really didn't need to. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was in April of 2002 that I'm living with my friend, but when Israel made their major invasion of the West Bank, all the major cities. So for weeks on end, we were under curfew, tanks in the streets, bombs going off all night, you know, sound bombs, percussion bombs.
Mm-hmm. What is the purpose of the percussion bomb?
To scare people. It makes a hell of a big, just to make noise.
So it's audio terror. And also, I believe those percussion bombs can cause injury, at least to very sensitive ears, such as the ears of children. And also, it's been pointed out in recent years that these kinds of weapons also wreak havoc with the psyche of developing minds of young children. Isn't that?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, sure. And I tell you what parents did. Parents would tell their children it's just a game. They had their children convinced that not to worry. Mm-hmm. You know, so the children, the parents told stories that it was some kind of a game and that they, you know, don't be upset.
Well, what else could they tell them if they're trying to watch out for their children or trying to protect them, and they know that they're all going to be subjected to this environment for an extended time? What else could they possibly say?
Yeah. Well, it just went on and on. And it was difficult to me to know if I could go to work or not. You know, if I could manage to go from where I was living, walk to the university. There were days when I was in the office and I looked out the window and there's army vehicles going around the university, you know, very unnerving for me, but Palestinians are so used to it. It's just so normal that they're really, even the women are not afraid. They're just, they've worked it all out. Mm-hmm. They just go about their lives as best they can. And I could tell you so many stories, but I'm trying to keep on track. Uh-huh. There was a long time. Nobody could go to work. Nobody could go to the university. We were under curfew. We weren't allowed to leave, and even my friend, when I wanted to get up on a chair and look out the space above the door to see what was going on, he was afraid to even let me do that.
So this was curfew. This was a curfew even during daylight hours?
Oh, yeah. We could not go out. And then they would announce they would lift the curfew for a couple of hours, and, you know, then you can go out and get food, you know. But, you know, there were a few times that I broke curfew and I just went out anyway. And some of the shops would be open, but their door would be just open a little, you know? So, there were times I would be inside the store and they'd just have to close it and turn off the lights when they hear a tank coming, you know? And, you know, it wasn't just tanks in the street, you know? It was tanks going up on the sidewalk and destroying these beautiful interlocking paved stone sidewalks that some European country paid for, you know. When I went out after the army had left, They had shot up the windows and doors of every shop in town. There just wasn't a window that wasn't destroyed. They shot up. We had these beautiful little, I mean, quite impractical garbage receptacles on the streets, bought by some European country. Well, they shot them full of holes. You know, this is not fighting terrorism. And my bank.
Yes.
They broke into the bank and destroyed the computers, and they drove a tank into the ATM machine. You know?
Yes.
It was just unbelievable.
I guess this is the Israelis' idea of fighting terror, huh?
Well, okay.
I have a little calendar in my. I have a little calendar.
Can you hear me properly?
Can I hear you?
Yes.
I can hear you. I'm right now. I'm fiddling with some headphones because. My first priority is to get the sound, all the sound qualities right for the broadcast and for the recording, because this show is being recorded, and I know it's especially important for you, David, to be able to access this recording for your family and for maybe for other purposes. So let me go ahead and remind everyone that this is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. This program, like all the others that I do here on Free Radio, is being recorded and will be archived. The archived location for this program is radioforall.net. That's radio, R-A-D-I-O, the number 4, A-L-L.net, radioforall.net. Mm-hmm. Go to that site and type in Mideast Migraines. You will find the collection of shows under that show's title, and anyone has free access. You don't even have to subscribe to it or pay anything to the podcast. And you can download the podcast for this or any other available show to listen to at your leisure when and where you want to. So that's part of what I'm talking about, David. I have to make sure that the sound quality is best for the recording and for the broadcast. That one thing that means is I have to turn the internal studio volume down a little to help avoid feedback, but I'm messing with my headphones here. Just hang on a second. And that's not it. Hello. Okay, I found the proper pot. Okay. David, say something.
Hello.
Okay, good.
Hello.
Yeah, I can hear you a little better in my headphones now, which is good, so I can turn down the studio audio, and I can see on the board that we're broadcasting well. Okay, but you sound okay. So, please, can you continue where you left off from?
Where I left off from. Uh-huh. Okay.
I was going to ask. I'm sorry. I just remembered. I have the internal calendar in my mind here. Do I understand correctly that this is during the Second Intifada?
This is the Second Intifada. Okay. Let me give your listeners a little background.
Okay.
Okay. Like I said, I went in December of 2000. The Second Intifada started September 29. Of 2000, as a result of a visit paid by General Ariel Sharon with about 1,000 police soldiers, a large gathering went to the Haram al-Sharif of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, invaded, and that's a deliberate provocation. These are things, you know, the Israelis do these things.
Yes.
Anyone who has read, this is a method of theirs. But
also a favorite tactic. It's also a favorite.
Truth be told, I would not have known what Intifada meant, before I went there. Okay. Also, I want to, for anyone who, would like to know where Nablus is located, it's in the West Bank, nothing to do with Gaza, although I did meet people from Gaza, some of whom were working as policemen in Nablus. But Nablus is located north of Ramallah, and the reason they call it the West Bank is because it's north of the Jordan River. Okay?
Right.
Did I say...
You said north of the Jordan River. West of the Jordan River. Okay.
The reason they call it the West Bank is that it's west of the Jordan River.
So Nablus is north of Ramallah, and Ramallah itself is what, north of Jerusalem?
It's just north a bit and east.
To the east, okay. So Ramallah is somewhat northeast of Jerusalem, and then to the north of Ramallah is Nablus.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. Making that text ride from Ramallah to Nablus at a certain time of the year, there are wildflowers that look red, wildflowers that are kind of poppies, and then there are yellow flowers. I really loved it there.
Mm-hmm. My father is a native of Jerusalem. And his family basically lived, and he grew up in the environs of Jerusalem. My father's family was Christian. They were actually Lutheran. And when my father eventually settled and married an American woman here in California, I grew up in the Lutheran church, as a Lutheran, attending Sunday services. And I also grew up with a collection of family photos and some pictures of old Palestine and spreads from National Geographic magazine of the great colorful beauty of Jerusalem. So I have a picture of it in my own mind. I've never been to Jerusalem nor to the West Bank, but I have visited the Gaza Strip, and I spent about a week there, and that was in August of 2008. So that's my very brief story of hands-on experience.
No, but a week in Gaza, I'm sure you have a lot of stories to tell. A lot can happen in a week.
Well, it happened to be, I don't really want to get into my story right now because I don't want to take time from you, but it was the year, I was there in August of 08, which is... and left around Labor Day, first weekend in September, United States holiday. And it was some 3.5 months later when Israel invaded in their infamous, horrendous Operation Cast Lead. Israel attacked the Gaza Strip a few weeks before their national election, very interestingly enough. And they did the same thing in November, the very same thing, but the same political circumstances in November of 2012, just before a national election. And it was like, let's kill a couple of thousand Arabs so we can get elected again, kind of thing. That's what, after I read all the pertinent information, that's what it felt like to me. It's quite obvious to me. So, yes, I escaped with my life probably by the thin sliver of 3.5 months. So, then I would really have some stories to tell if I had survived that. But I was, in terms of my personal well-being, I was extremely fortunate. I did not see any direct molestation by the Israelis during my visit, but I did see some bombed-out buildings and a bombed-out factory and other indications of the economic siege of Gaza. So just as a kind of afterthought, I did see some of that. So please go ahead,
very good.
David.
One thing I want to mention is you brought up the subject that you come from a Christian family.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to mention that in Nablus is not completely Muslim. There was a large church under construction while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were, one little memory I have is that while we were stuck in our room, There was a Christian lady who came around delivering bread that she had. I don't know whether she made it or where she got it from, but she would stick it through our window, you know, and that was very nice. And the fact is that Muslims and Christians get along very well, despite what you might have heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, yeah. Okay. So I don't know where you want me to go from here. I did some very interesting work at the university, but like I said, you know, I mean, I remember one time, you know, and we started early because especially during hot weather, we started 8 o'clock in the morning, finish at 3, and you're walking down the hill from the university. And just as I'm walking down the hill, there's a tank coming up. And I just ran into the closest alleyway and tried to hit myself. So that's what it was like. It was, you know, sometimes I didn't know whether I could go to work or not, but I really loved the work. And although I was able to take Arabic classes, and I learned to read Arabic, you know, and I'm in my late 50s at this time.
Uh-huh.
And I learned I can read. I never learned to write. I can't make my hand move like that. And I learned to speak, you know. But unfortunately, where I live in Morocco, the Arabic is nothing the same. It's just not even similar.
Mm.
But, yeah. Later on, and I don't know if you're having anyone phone in, but I'm willing to answer anyone's questions.
Okay.
And they could even have my... your listeners could even have my email if they wanted to write to me.
Okay, well, let's do that now. Let's open up the phone line. In fact, I may as well open up both of them. We did have some difficulty a week or two ago with the telephones or with one of the two lines, but I think we've got that. We tested them last night. I was here in the studio with some other members of the collective, and the phones seem to be working fine now. Okay, the area code for the studio here, which is located in Santa Cruz County, California. This is the West Central Coast, or the Central Coast of California, of course, where it is currently 3:39 p.m., or 15:39 hours Pacific Daylight Time. The phone lines direct to the studio, area code for both lines is 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. Once again, area 831, 427-3772. And the line number 2, 831-469-3119. Again, line 2 is 469-3119. And interestingly, in terms of this interview, David, it's another hairbreadth good fortune for us. Up until yesterday, our radio broadcast antenna was not working for roughly 24 hours, maybe 36 hours. But that was also taken care of yesterday. Here, let me see if I can hear it in the studio. Yep. So we are broadcasting at 101.3 FM within the city of Santa Cruz. And we're also broadcasting at freakradio.org. Of course, you'll have to click on the red oval that's you'll find on top of the picture of the radio tower there to get the streaming link. But we are both broadcasting on air and over the net right now. So those are the phone lines. The phones are open. David, we can use your email address, or I can just give him the one for the program, however you want to do it.
No, take mine. Do you want me to write it? Do you want me to type it for you?
Go ahead and give that out.
Do you want me to just tell it to you?
Just tell it to us, please.
Okay, David Vickery, D-A-V-I-D, V-I-C-K-E-R-Y, all together, David Vickery, dot 2013 at ymail.com.
And ymail is all one word?
Yes.
I was thinking there was a hyphen between y and mail. Is that not true?
No.
Okay.
No,
it's just
davidvickery.2013@ymail.com.
davidvickery.2013@ymail.com. Okay. Well, I'd exactly. be anxious to find out if you get any response to that. And, incidentally, I'm just checking our program. There are a few people listening online, according to the information I have here. We do have a program that actually monitors the number of people. It's not like we know who you are, folks, or where you are, but we do have numbers. And there is a small number of people actually listening online. So just so you know. Okay, so while we're waiting for phone calls, let me ask you a few questions, David. As I said at the beginning of the interview, I was touched, frankly, and impressed by your deft handling, your sensitive handling of the things that other people had to say on the Amazon website in regards to reviews for Blumenthal's book. And what happens is, folks, it gets really hairy because there is a book for sale, and the details of on Amazon of the number of books they have and the prices, of course, are there. And then they give the readers an opportunity to review the book themselves. This is for, I guess, any literary material they have for sale. Mm-hmm. And so you have people who make reviews, and the reviews are now in the, I believe it's roughly 260-odd reviews of the book right now. And then they go on to give you an opportunity to post your reactions to the review. And then you got other people who chime in with their reactions to the person who posted the last post. And there are, before long, it's almost inevitable that people begin to deviate from the original idea, which is just to respond to the review of the book. Of course, it is a discussion, so people are pretty much free to say what they want, although they do have community standards that Amazon writes up for not using nasty language and things like that. But there are some people who call in who are so ardently, passionately, or even maniacally on one side of the fence or the other. And I came to anytime I would see David's name up there in response to someone else's post or to present some new material, I read what he had to say with glee and with just anxious to see what he had to say. Now, I put so much attention on what I wanted to hear from you and what your story was. I probably did not give so much attention to what I was going to say, but I guess the idea for interviewing you, David, stems from the fact that you applauded my reading of the book, and I thought, well, that's nice. Why don't we just talk to David? Because you did say you lived in the West Bank for a little over 2 years. And I wanted to know, and you've told us that story now, how you came there and how you came to stay there. You also said something about being deported, either from Israel or from the West Bank. Well, can you tell us anything about those details?
There's something else I want to tell you about first.
Okay.
But I really want to tell you about that, what happened to me and that led up to my deportation. But I want to tell you about, you see, my friend, his name was Saad, sad. Came from Jenin refugee camp in the far north, north of Nablus. Came from Jenin refugee camp.
Yes.
And some of you may have heard about the Jenin refugee camp massacre, you know, and there are all sorts of people out there are going to tell you, oh, no, it wasn't a massacre. Okay. But that happened in April, just like what happened in Nablus happened in April of 2002, it was. Okay. So, and, you know, like there, by November, it became possible to actually take a taxi and travel there. So I insisted on going, and you know, I wanted to see his family, and I wanted to have a look. And we ended up staying with his mother's. His mother had died years before, but we stayed with his mother's sister and her husband, and I think they had three children. The man, when we arrived, and it was late in the day, he was inside a concrete cistern that he had built with a flashlight, checking it all out because he was expecting a water truck. Okay, a water truck was coming.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let me tell you what happened, what came instead.
Okay.
What came instead was the Israeli army while we were there in their house. And let me tell you about the house. What we saw there was that if you look at the doorways inside, you could see that the whole house had been distorted because, you know what? The Israelis had come with their bulldozer, their huge Cat D9 bulldozer, and hacked off the front of that house. There were no, you know, the whole front of the house was gone. And the repair, you know, I can see where the man of the house had done some repair work inside. And all of us just slept on pads in the living room. That's all there was. That was the only place to sleep. And I saw that entire, you know, that was from April to November. All of that family, I would say they were suffering from PTSD. The guy could barely speak. Oh, the children, everyone was disheveled, just like zombies, really. Absolutely.
And
like
how
that.
Long after the alleged massacre was this?
This was, okay, that happened in April, and I was there near the end of November. I saw a huge, like a football field-sized area that had been just completely empty, where homes had once been. That's what they did with their bulldozers. Ran, you know the story I posted on Amazon. Of that one Israeli bulldozer driver who worked for 75 hours non-stop, fueled by whiskey. He was proud of himself. He said he would have kept going.
Yeah, it also sounds a little like some parts of the chapters of Goliath. But David, this phenomenon of bulldozing houses, mowing down whole blocks of homes, yeah. And I saw this on the Egyptian border in Gaza, where they had eliminated several blocks simply because they wanted to reduce or eliminate access through houses to Egypt to tunnels. So their draconian way.
They claimed there were tunnels. From, you know, inside the houses. I don't know if that's true or not, but that at Rafah, that's where Rachel Corrie was killed by a bulldozer.
Yes, and we saw
Rachel
that.
Rachel Corrie was,
We were at that location where that happened, and it's my point is that this is what the very definition of draconian. You eliminate the possibility of Palestinians access to tunnels by completely eliminating the presence of the Palestinians, and you do that by getting rid of their domiciles. So, David, the thing is, we know this is very commonplace, and this is standard procedure for the Israelis. I want to know about Jenin. Did you see, what was there any evidence of massacre of individuals that you either saw or became privy to?
Okay, it turns out that I think, I forget the exact figure, it was something like 57 people. So, you know, some people will say, well, that's not a massacre. But it certainly terrified the entire place.
Uh-huh.
You know, even when, you know, I was there and we were having to run. We had to run. Mm-hmm. They were shooting, and the young guys are out there ready to throw their stones, you know, and get shot like they always do, mm-hmm. you know. But we had to run, and actually, as we were leaving, we actually crossed a road right behind a bulldozer, like, I don't know what got into me, but I seem to be more brave than my Palestinian friend, because we just ran across that road right behind the bulldozer. And we got just barely outside of the camp, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But they were everywhere. The army was everywhere. And there was no way we could leave. Taxis were certainly not running, okay? So you know what? The first, we're just barely outside the camp. And I said to him, We came to a house that had a big wall around it, and he said, "Let's go to that house and ask them if we can stay the night, you know, give us shelter." And you know what? And that was a big house. There was a huge family living there. I think it was three stories, extended family. All the six sons were living there, with all their children. And you know what? We stayed there for an entire week before we could get out. And I had left work. I said, I'm going away for the weekend. Well, we were there for a week. And just over the side, over their garden wall was all the shooting going on. And I don't know how many, they had so many little kids there that, you know, it was just a wonderful time for me.
Uh-huh.
There was actually an ambulance running around the city of Jenin delivering bread.
No terrorists.
That's what it was like.
They weren't carting terrorists. The ambulances weren't carting terrorists around, were they? Because that's the usual allegation.
Oh, no. You know what? There was once when the president of the university, in order to go to Ramallah to meet with Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat was alive in those days.
Mm-hmm.
In order for him to travel to Ramallah, he had to put him in an ambulance and pose as a patient. That's what the president of the university had to do in order to get to Ramallah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway. That could be.
So that's Jenin. And after the week that we stayed with that family, and you know what, during the entire time, I met all their little kids, and the man brought out his little daughter because he was especially proud of this little daughter because he and his wife were older. You know, they were definitely in their 40s. And they had this little baby girl, and they ended up giving me a picture of that kid. You know, so once we were finally able to get a taxi out of there, I remember as we were in the taxi and there's a tank still sitting there with his cannon pointing at us, right at our car.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so you want to talk about when I was deported?
I'm sorry. Talk about what?
You mentioned that you wanted me to tell about what led to my deportation.
Yeah, I do. I want to hear that. But if I can just add one or two quick things about Jenin, I did This was some 12 years ago, and I seem to recall that the initial allegations went into about 500 suspected killings by the Israelis, a massacre of some 500. Now, if that had happened, apparently so much water is under the bridge, and so much sabotage of the evidence would have occurred that it's probably impossible at this point to say by now if it was that bad. But I do remember reading one story about how when an independent or quasi-independent group of investigators wanted to visit Jenin and examine the evidence, they were initially turned down by the Israeli Defense Forces. The main reason being, as I understood it, that the mere fact, not any evidence or allegations that they came across, but the mere fact that such an investigative team would have been allowed to go about their business there would have been a stain on the honor of the Israeli army and would have hurt them emotionally or something like that. This seemed to be the main concern and the main reason why they would not permit an initial outside investigation. Did you hear anything like that?
Yes. And it's absolutely typical.
Yes. And, of course, as I said, water under the bridge, people tried to say, well, eventually it was determined there was no such massacre. But the problem with a certain number of months and years passing is that that the connections are lost and certain people are dead and gone. It's impossible to if you cannot get a proper investigation done in a reasonable amount of time, then the crime will go forever unpunished. Okay, that's just the piece that I wanted to pay. So please, David, tell us about the circumstances of your deportation.
You just reminded me of Quiva Butterly, the name of an Irish nurse who actually was living in Jenin refugee camp. And the army comes and goes all the time, it's not. One time she was protecting a group of children, and the Israeli arm, she was shot through her thigh. The bullet went right through her thigh.
Mm-hmm.
The army took her without documents, like arrested her, and dropped her across the border in Jordan with nothing, with no money, no documents, anything.
Oh, okay.
That's what happened to her.
Okay.
And I ended up, I actually met her. She actually came into my office when I was working at the university, and we had a conversation. So absolutely lovely, lovely young woman, just a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get to June. It's June of 2003 by now.
Okay.
Near the end of June. And, from time to time, I absolutely felt the need to get away from Nablus. And I would go to Jerusalem, stay at the Faisal Hostel for a while, and it was a totally different atmosphere there, just absolutely different.
Let me break in here, David, because we're at the top of the hour. I just want to remind everyone, you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, and we are streaming online at freakradio.org. For now and for future reference, remember to click on the red oval so that you may pick up the streaming link. And this is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil, also known as Lawrence Tawil. And we are interviewing David James Vickery, a Canadian man who lives in the nation of Morocco in North Africa. This is a live interview at 4:01 p.m. Pacific time on May the 5th, 2014. Okay, go ahead, David.
Okay, so I was in a bus with Palestinians, and we got stopped at an unexpected checkpoint. They took one look at my passport and saw my visa stamp, and immediately took me. And I left me sitting there in the hot sun for hours, mm-hmm. and I survived that. And then they took me in for questioning, and I was made to sign a statement. And I told them the exact truth, everything I did at the university, how I helped students fill out forms to continue their education uh-huh. in Europe or... You know, in Europe, I did so many things there, very interesting work. They were not happy one little bit. And they took me to the...
Why were they not happy with it? Why were they upset?
Two and a half years on a three-month Israeli visa.
Ran. Oh, I see.
Yes, and they weren't happy that I was living with Palestinians mm-hmm. safely. Without a moment of danger from Palestinians. I want to emphasize that. Okay?
Okay.
Yes. They took me to, after questioning, they took me to Ramleh Immigration Prison, where that was a Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And... very interesting experience, because it was an immigration prison. I was there for a week, exactly 1 week. I met, not criminals, but I met people from many, many different countries, a lot of Africans, Chinese, Eastern Europe, Russia, even a guy from India, who had gone there to work. Because Israel was denying work to the Palestinians. So these foreign workers had gone, skilled workers, a lot of them.
Yes.
Had even, you know, had stayed as much as 10 years, gone way over their visa, had developed relations with Israeli women, you know. And some of these women even came to the prison to visit them. This is, you know, and so I, you know, inside of a week, it was very interesting experience. And I got to speak to anyone who spoke English. And, you know, one of the Africans, you know, we were free. We all got together in one of their rooms one time in one of their, it was like rooms, you know, locked rooms with bars on the window, you know, bars, multiple bars on the window. They were so paranoid about escape. The Israeli jailers, they're just kind of, paranoid is the right word for mm-hmm. their behavior. But anyway, you know what? A sweet memory is that some of these Africans took me in, and one of them chanted from the little Quran he had, you know? And that was, you know, kind of sing-songy voice, and I enjoyed that. So anyway, towards the, you know, it got to be at the end of the week, I'm running out of money for a phone card. And I, you know, I did get the from the Canadian embassy.
How could you have been running out of money if you were behind bars? What, you mean you happen to have a small amount?
I had little money at the time.
Okay.
And I had spent money on phone cards.
Okay.
One of the prisoners was selling phone cards. So my representative from the Canadian embassy came, you know, to help me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And this man shows up with his little Jewish kippah on top of his head, and tells me I had done wrong. I had done something bad, and I was being punished. So this is the help I got from the Canadian embassy in Tel Aviv.
Hmm.
Anyway, so I hope you're ready to listen to all of this, because from there, this prison consists of several buildings. And anyway, we're all taken to the airport. We're all taken to Ben Gurion Airport and assembled into a huge auditorium. And so, you know, I saw people, there were some women there actually from Eastern Europe who were working as prostitutes, and they were being deported. And but it's just a huge room, huge room full of people. All the luggage, the Africans like to have these huge suitcases, and that was all piled up along the aisle. And they began calling out names, and one by one, people were, going out, boarding their flights. This was started on a Thursday night. I had been from a Thursday to a Thursday in the prison, so this was a Thursday night at 7:30. One by one, these people were called, and I'm waiting. We're all waiting, and the Africans are turning a little gray. They're so tired. And guess who was the one sitting there at 8 o'clock in the morning? I was left sitting there. I was the last one sitting there. And they took me to a cell where I stayed for until Sunday, isolation cell. I got fed, but I was completely alone. And on Sunday, they have a tactic of denying food and sleep. And that's what I was for like 2 days. They kept interrupting. They wanted to check my luggage for one excuse or another. And I got no sleep. And then in the morning, they took me to a plane. And I got on the plane, and, they gave my passport to the pilot. And I still have Israeli shekels in my pocket. This is my money. And here I'm thinking I'm going to Canada. Huh? I'm being deported to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't tell you. Guess where I landed?
Jerusalem.
I landed in the Czech Republic. No, I landed in the Czech Republic.
Okay.
I'm at the airport, so I saw Prague from the air.
So did they leave it up to you to find your own way from the Czech Republic to...
No. Then I'm on another plane, and that's when they hand me my passport. And everything is really normal after that. I got fed. Everything was perfectly fine when I landed in Canada. I had to change my shekels into dollars, and I managed to get to a friend's place. But it was tremendous. It's just tremendous because of the lack of sleep. But luckily, on that last plane, I managed to get a good meal. But I can tell you, once I landed in Canada, I couldn't stop talking. I just wanted everyone to know. I found that among Canadians, they weren't terribly interested.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, especially, I thought it was also really, really interesting, and I sure wanted to talk about it.
You wanted to talk about the circumstances surrounding your deportation?
I wanted to talk about everything, mm-hmm. just so full of stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But,
Regarding the apathy of Canadians regarding events in Israel and Palestine, I was informed here recently that, at least in terms of the mainstream Canadian press, it's just about as bad, which is to say, it's just about as the bias is about as pro-Israel there as it is in the United States.
OK, Canada has their own version of AIPAC.
Yes.
That's the truth.
Yeah. And in the meantime, yeah. Israel sends their spies and has an espionage network active not only in the United States, but in key places in Canada as well.
Yeah. Do you know, did you hear that, I don't know if it, a law has passed or if it's pending, but apparently in Canada, it will become illegal to criticize Israel.
Is that recent news?
That's news, yeah.
Well, I'll...
We can be charged with anti-Semitism by telling the truth about the actions of Israel.
Well, if you can provide me with any more details about that law, David, go ahead and send it either to my personal email or to MideastMadness@gmx.com. Yeah. I would appreciate it. Interesting you should say that, because about a year and a half ago, based on information I had read from an article several years before, I wrote an essay, you know, an op-ed for the local newspaper here, Santa Cruz Sentinel, declaring that that was already the case in the United States, that it is illegal, literally illegal, for someone to criticize Israel. And I was basing that on the potential utilization of two existing laws that were passed separately from one another. One of them was hate crimes legislation, and the other one was... my mind is blanking out on me, but the impression I got from the article was that with the precedent being able to be set by the application of these two laws, it was now possible to take someone to court and possibly to punish them for criticizing Israel. Turns out that the individual who wrote this article, his name is Paul Craig Roberts. Now, that name might resonate with some people. Paul Craig Roberts became somewhat of a dissident from U.S. policy. He worked under the Ronald Reagan presidency as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, I believe. But he is someone who became so aware of the Israeli influence on American politics that he came to see this, at least in his own mind, as being the case. Apparently, he's not an attorney, and I think I may have made some assumptions before I wrote that opinion editorial that he was a legal person. But he would not verify for me when I did get around to writing him that he was an attorney. But in his mind, it pretty much amounts to the same thing, even if it's not that way on the books. A person can be severely ostracized in the United States for showing any solidarity with Palestinians, and that is a fact. In very many cases, there was a professor, a woman, I believe, out in North Carolina who was initially not only denied promotion that she was anticipating in her department because she showed a pro-Palestinian film in one of her classes, but they canned her, they fired her, and I do not know if that situation was resolved for her. There is another famous, I keep saying famous, a person of notoriety, Dr. Mark Elliott, I believe his name was, a Jewish man who... was employed at Baylor University in Texas, and he similarly exercised what he thought was a balanced view of the situation in Israel and Palestine in his classroom, and he was he got into trouble big time, and he was effectively pulled from his job, and he relocated himself. And this was a Jewish man. And there are getting more and more examples.
And, of course, it's common knowledge what happened to Norman Finkelstein.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Dr. Norman Finkelstein.
Well, they got him bad because he was one of the first not only Jewish individuals to dare to to separate from the pro-Israel camp, but because he was extremely successful in drawing attention to the negative aspects of Zionist Israel. And this is why they hate him so much, and why they why Israel banned him from Israel for 10 years, and why he was ostracized. One speaking engagement after another, even when Mr. Finkelstein spoke some 10 years ago in Santa Cruz, which was not the last time he spoke here. But when he made that talk about 10 years ago, there were a couple of hundred people whom he drew into that auditorium, and the American Jewish community, the pro-Israel community, was out with placards and picket lines at the mere fact that he was here. So he certainly does bring a lot of attention. So anyway,
he speaks the truth, and this is, and Norman Finkelstein is a man who both parents had been in concentration camps during the war.
Yes,
and all his extended family were exterminated. And what he says is, he will not allow that. Allow the Palestinians to be punished for what happened to the Jews. Forget his exact words, but it's desecrating the memory of all those who died in the concentration camps to turn around and do much similar, to the native Palestinians. And that is the truth. That's no exaggeration.
Yeah, and this kind of talk, whenever anyone, Jewish or not Jewish, brings up a comparison between Israeli atrocities and Nazi atrocities and tries to put the Israelis' feet to the fire on that count, they are assailed. They are assaulted in the press. They are this kind of talk raises the hackles of people who support Israel. They just don't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah, we're getting into some really emotional stuff here.
Yeah, we're getting close to the line here. I'm ready to say, well. And I think we really can't go there, can we?
We can. This is pirate radio, and we can say what we want.
Okay.
I'm recording it for posterity.
Okay. Well, I can tell you about Canada. I don't know really who owns the newspapers in the United States, but I can tell you in Canada, more than 90% of the newspapers. A television station are owned by one Jewish family, the Asper family. You know, newspapers, the National Post, Canada's national newspaper, is owned by the Asper family. Uh-huh. And you just do not, you'll never find anything there critical of Israel.
A friend of mine who is currently living in Prince Edward Island because her late mother, that was her last permanent residence. And she and my friend Kathy, she remains in Prince Edward Island. A few months ago, she sent us an article through the postal mail that did appear in the Charlotte newspaper, which I thought was quite remarkable. It was a medium-sized story about how a couple who spent some time in Palestine is trying to educate people in the Charlotte community about circumstances over there. And luckily, the article was not full of a lot of details. It was somewhat repetitive, but at least they admitted that there was such a Canadian couple who would do this. Here, David, you presented some information to the posts on the Amazon.com website in relation to reviews of Max Blumenthal's book. You came across something and you submitted it to us all, and I think you were directing it in particular to one or two people who you wanted to get comments from. The story of the Palestinian soccer players. You provided a link, and you also, I believe, you know, CNP'd the whole story that you had, how the players on the national Palestinian soccer team, as they see it, a national team, were trying to cross a checkpoint, trying to go through a checkpoint, and something happened, and as what happens more often than not, they were shot. And in this particular case, the Israeli border guards, clearly having already seen their papers and knowing who they were, deliberately shot the feet of these Palestinian ball players. Two of them, one of them was, I believe, shot 10 times in the feet and ankles, and the other in the feet, and which pretty much... Well, that put them out of business. That finished their soccer career,
yeah,
or their football career.
They were taken to a hospital in Ramallah.
Yes,
they had just come from their soccer practice, so they were, you know, and they were taken. The doctors at the hospital in Ramallah said they'll never play sports again.
So the border border guards knew exactly who these guys were and deliberately shot them in the feet. I don't know how often Palestinians get shot in the feet, but that can't be a coincidence. Well, here I have a follow-up article from Mondo Vice, which is an online news outlet. Red card for racism. Activists demand FIFA kick out Israel. This was written by Annie Robbins on May 2nd. 3 days ago. Let me just start reading it to you.
Yeah, please do, because I saw it. I saw the article, but I haven't read it.
Okay, last March we at MondoWise reported, Jibril Al-Rajoub, chairman of the Palestinian Football Association, demanded the expulsion of Israel from FIFA. FIFA is the International Federation of Football, or as we would call it in the United States, soccer. The world football game, demanded the expulsion of Israel from FIFA and the International Olympic Committee as a result of, quote, Israeli brutality, emphasizing, quote, the occupation's insistence on destroying Palestinian sport. Last summer, FIFA president Sepp Blatter stated he would set up a task force to deal with the many problems Palestinians must deal with sporting under occupation. Those, quote, unquote, problems include everything from travel restrictions to the arrest, torture, maiming, and killing of Palestinian athletes. At this time, Al-Rajoub threatened he would, and I quote, call on delegates at the next FIFA Congress to expel Israel. That article goes on to say here, that time has come. The FIFA Congress is meeting again days before the World Cup begins on June 12th in Brazil next month. Supporters of Palestinian footballers are fed up, and we are demanding Israel be kicked out of FIFA. An international campaign of sports activists, Red Card Israeli Racism, or IRCR, believes, quote, we can bring pressure on Israel to drop its racism and apartheid policies and laws, end quotes. Their objectives include exclusion of the IFA, I guess that would be the Israeli Football Association, from hosting any Euro 2020 tournaments, replacement of Israel as host of the UEFA 2015 Women's U19 tournament, boycott by United Kingdom teams and players of any tournaments planned in Israel and of any matches with Israeli teams, and direct support of Palestinian football teams. They have a petition going. The IRCR's petition, entitled Suspend the Israeli Football Association's FIFA Membership, mm-hmm. is available at Mondovice here. Obviously, Mondovice is highly supportive of Palestine. The petition picked up thousands of supporters after details of the horrifying attack on two Palestinian soccer players, cousins, Jauhar Nasser Jauhar, 19, and Adam Abd al-Rouf, Albia, 17, reported by Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation, in March. And it's the article goes on and on, but I wanted to let you know I'm glad that you're aware of the Mondo Vice article, but also to refresh my listeners to the Mideast Migraine Show, that there is definitely movement afoot to punish Israel and to put them and the sports world into the proper perspective of the fact that. You know, you don't hear about, for example, Peruvian policemen shooting the feet of Brazilian football players. How often does this kind of thing happen anywhere else in the world? And how is it that Israel could otherwise be relieved of accountability for this crime?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the truth is slowly... The truth is slowly filtering down to more mainstream news sources, just slowly. It's taken a very long time, but it's starting to come out. People are becoming less afraid to speak out.
I think that's inevitable, considering how utterly blatant Israel's crimes are becoming, with more and more coverage, more... the professionalism undertaken by groups like Al Jazeera and Al Jazeera English, the fact that there is an exercise, more and more exercise of freedom of speech and freedom of reporting in the Middle East, which by and large is destined to not do Israel a lot of good, because it has been, you know, Israel is used to hiding behind its veneer of democracy, this pretense democracy, and shaming the rest of the Arab world for not having their sophisticated development Western sensibilities of freedom of the press. But indeed, Israel, in fact, commits so many awful crimes and getting away with people subscribing to the veneer, to the notion that Israel is the good guy. And
I think,
yes.
Most Israelis themselves, most real Israelis, citizens, are just as propagandized as anyone else in the West. They believe what they see on television and read in the newspapers. They have absolutely no contact with these Palestinians, who maybe actually live maybe 20 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The thing is, that is a big part of the problem, is that they believe the stereotype. They think they're terrorists, and they don't want to think about it. They really don't give much thought to the Palestinians. They're just too busy living their lives. But I think it's a big part of the problem that they don't get to meet each other, except as soldiers. Soldiers, mostly, and you know, those people who grow up to become soldiers are brainwashed from their time from kindergarten, practically.
Yeah, it's soldiers. Israeli military people are especially hardened. They are, as Max Blumenthal described in some parts of the book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. So it's some of there is an underlying, you have children in kindergarten and grade school who play little war games, and the Arabs are the bad guys. And of course, even though I have the book with me here, I can't remember it all verbatim. But this is drilled into them from a very young age, and they're taught that the Arabs want to kill all of them. And this is done with dramatic graphics that they see in media presentations in the classroom and in television. That this is a simple matter of we have to. In some cases, kill the Arabs before they kill us. Also, you were talking about how on the one hand, an Israeli can live only 20 minutes away from occupied territory. Every crossing, and even in some isolated spots on the Green Line, however that is configured now, there are signs written in Hebrew and English warning Israelis, do not go past this point. There is great danger. it says to the effect of you are forbidden from going into this zone. And then as Miko Peled, who is another Israeli Jewish hero in my eyes, who is coming out of the fray and starting to describe things there as they really are. He talked about the time when he went ahead and broke the rule and crossed one of these, went past these signs, and he saw people living their lives in another part of Palestine there that he had previously been unaware of. It's just people going about their business, going about their lives in the most vital ways, that it's no different there than it is in Israel. So,
yes. Somehow you made me remember an old woman I met on the plane when I was flying over. When I originally went in 2000, I was on the plane flying from Toronto, and I'm sitting beside an old Jewish. The plane was full of Jewish people.
Uh-huh.
You know, going to Tel Aviv, and I'm sitting beside this elderly woman. And, you know, we got to talking, you know, quite friendly, and she asked me why I was going. I think she assumed I was Jewish because my name is David.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she told, she was going to visit her grandchildren. Her daughter lives in Israel. She has made many trips to visit her grandchildren in Israel. And she warned me, David, change your plans. Just go and have a holiday. And whatever you do, don't get into a taxi with a green license plate, because it'll be driven by an Arab, and he'll steal your money.
Mm-hmm.
This is what the woman said to me, you know. So you know what? You can be an Israeli, or you can visit Israel as many times as you like. You don't really know.
It is amazing. I actually have come across a number of people, both in person and online, who try to tell me, you know, I have lived there for 15 years. I have lived in Israel for 25, 30 years, and I know what I'm talking about. But this, and then they tell me positive story about the Israelis and you know what they're up against and how you can trust the Israelis but you cannot trust the Arabs. And these are people who live there, but everything they're telling me just flies in the face of all the other messages and stories.
Well, such
that
people
I'm getting
should be told. Like one time I was in Ramallah, I had to go to a bank, and I'm walking through a neighborhood I had never been before. I'm walking past a man working in his garden, beautiful rose garden, Palestinian man, working in his rose garden, and he could see me admiring his roses. So what did he do? He cut me a most beautiful, and gave me a rose, for God's sake. You know, this is a Palestinian.
But how do you know he wasn't just giving you the rose to convince you that Palestinians were decent human beings at heart? How do you know he wasn't just a shill for the Palestinian cause?
Right.
Well, you were there, so I'm sure you have a much better feeling for what was going on. I'm not going to challenge that.
Yeah. Honestly.
Well, David, well, okay, let me just come out and ask you. You've lived in Morocco for 5 years now. Are you a Muslim?
Okay. I fast during Ramadan. Oh, let me tell you something else first. When I was deported, I was banned from Israel, from entering Israel. And you can't go to Palestine without going through Israel, Israeli security, you know? Mm-hmm. So they banned me for 10 years. And I know very well, even though the 10 years have passed, I have no hope of getting through their security. They send me right back.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so I'm sitting there in Canada, and getting close to the age of 65, and I'm making plans, and I want to move. I want to go to another country. And I started looking in North Africa, because to tell you the truth, I wanted to live in another Muslim country. And just to expand on my knowledge, you know, expand on my, because I'm an observer of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose Morocco. I chose Morocco absolutely arbitrarily. Arbitrarily, you know what? You know, and it's not perfect. Some on an online travel forum, somebody suggested Tahrir. So this is where I am. This is where I came on May the 2nd, 2009. I just passed 5 years.
Okay.
You know, I had little annoyances, like, you know, because Morocco was occupied by France. People, you know, a lot of people who don't know me greet me in French, you know, and I have to try and explain. But people who know me, and I picked up, speak to me in the Moroccan dialect of Arabic. That's all I speak here. I never speak English.
Okay.
So you can see how much I'm enjoying speaking English.
Yeah, you might have mentioned something at the beginning of the talk. If your English is getting lousy because of the number of years you've spent in Morocco, that might have been helpful. That reminds me of a story. I shortly before my father's death in 1971, one of his immediate family members, my aunt or my uncle or someone, made the comment that somebody told him or her that my father's Arabic was getting lousy because he had spent some 40 years in the United States. That's just what it makes me think of. But okay, so to a degree you are in tune with the culture and the habits and perhaps the
From the time I set foot here, I have a very close Moroccan friend who was a good Muslim. He prays, oh God, I swear he prays more than 5 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't speak a word of English. And yet we've traveled around the country together. And so I fast during Ramadan. Yeah, I do. I never could before I came here. And I break the fast with people I know. But because I really wasn't raised in a Muslim culture, I really can't. I don't know. I don't pray. I can say the words that you say when you declare that you are a Muslim. That's easy enough to say. But because I wasn't raised in the culture, I'm sort of, even after 5 years, I can't say I'm a Muslim.
Cannot say that.
No, I can't.
Okay.
And I'm accepted here. I'm accepted here. I'm surrounded by Muslims. There are no other foreigners that I know of that live all year round here.
Mm-hmm.
I have never had a moment of that I could feel threatened or not welcome. Not at all.
Well, okay. Obviously, you feel comfortable there. And as you wrote in your introductory, on your profile remarks on Skype here, you mentioned that as soon as you turned 65, you made a choice to move to Morocco to be among Muslim Arabs. And then you say, I have not regretted the decision in the 5 years since.
No, I haven't regretted it. I should point out that Morocco is not exclusively an Arab country. It's a Berber country. All those countries across North Africa are Berber. And Islam was only introduced to Morocco in the 7th century.
Yes, but the language is predominantly Arabic, is it not?
It's Darija, which is they understand classical Arabic because they watch Egyptian television.
Uh-huh.
But what they speak now, there are a few words here and there that are the same as what I heard in Palestine. But but I can make myself understood.
Well, at least,
and of course they all speak French. And, you know, and other areas of Morocco were colonized by Portugal and Spain. So there are areas of Morocco where people still speak Spanish and Portuguese.
I'm curious as to I'm curious as to the name of the city where you live, or the town, or the village. What is it? Does it have a meaning, or what is the linguistic origin of that name?
Terradance, I really have no clue. Anyone who's listening can. It's T-A-R-O-U-D-A-N-T, and if you have internet, you can get pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You can get pictures. Yeah.
It's amazing. It just does not sound terribly Arabic to me. But of course, there are those Portuguese and French and various and Berber and various other influences. So,
yeah.
Well, certainly Morocco holds something for you. I'm sure the area is not. I'm sure the air is not nearly as polluted as Toronto's. And I guess,
well, that's another thing. You know, I was asthmatic for years. I was on inhalers all the time, and I don't use anything now.
That's wonderful.
That answers your question.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this, at your profile picture here. There it appears to be, it's a little blurry, but appears to be a lovely young woman in the background. Is this your special someone or your daughter?
That was taken. I'm 70 years old. Come on, Ren. that was taken in 2010.
Okay.
At the home of my friend, the family home of my friend Mubarak, in a village, a small village, 7 kilometers outside of Terradent. We went for dinner, and my son took that picture, and the young lady you see is my daughter, Margaret.
Okay. I thought that might be your daughter. Are you single? Do you live by yourself, or what's the deal?
I live by myself.
Okay. But again, in regards to, we've established that you were not, at least not officially, or not intrinsically Muslim. Were you Jewish, or were you Christian, or anything in particular when you grew up?
Oh, God. When I was a kid, we were forced to go to Sunday school.
Okay.
You know? And, I think I learned a hell of a lot. I really did. You know, I went to church when I got older. And I do have a pretty good handle on what Christianity is supposed to be.
Were you Catholic, or was it Catholic or non-Catholic?
No, it was United Church.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so we were not like evangelical Christians, like so many Americans are. But and I really can't say we were a Christian family. It's just that we were checked out to go to Sunday school, so Mom and Dad had some time alone together. On Sunday morning, you know.
Well, that couldn't have been the case for me, because going to church was always a family event. You had to go, so Mom and Dad were with us. okay, so we've established that David James Vickery, who was born in Canada, neither Jew nor Muslim, and sort of a Christian, has decided that he wants to live at this stage of his life.
And at this point in history, when so many people are afraid of and hate Muslims, let's point that out.
Yes. You never feel uncomfortable there. You don't feel isolated or ostracized. Tell me, are there other Christians there? Or I should say, are there Christians there?
No.
Really?
Absolutely not. There are no churches. No churches.
Okay. Well, you mean...
There are some French who actually come and go, who come and stay for a while and leave, but they don't really integrate the way I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But one thing that occurred to me, and I don't know how many people would want to agree with it, but from my understanding of Christianity, I see a lot of those qualities in the behavior of the Muslims around me.
What qualities?
And I am the way people behave with each other, the kindness they show to the poor, they give to the poor, the patience they show. Think these are kind of Christ-like qualities. Maybe I'm stretching it a bit, but this is what I think at times. And I sit, you know, I mean, I observe people. I don't spend all my time at home. I'll sit in the cafe and I just watch people just going about their ordinary lives. And I think it's beautiful. You know, I don't see if any time, like say some occasionally, a scuffle might break out between teenagers, huh? Mm-hmm. Or maybe in the heat of Ramadan, when people have fasted all day and tempers are getting frayed, and you know, there a little scuffle might break out. But you know what? People step in, and they stand between them and they calm it down very quickly. The police are never involved. It's like that.
Well, David Vickery, it's just as a reminder to my listeners, the show, this Mideast Madness, now Mideast Migraines program, I used to call it Mideast Madness until I decided that name was a little too, among other things, slightly overused. I think I'll change it to Mideast Migraines just to personalize it a little more. May also say something about the way I feel about this, all these issues once in a while. The program goes until 4:55, which is in 8 minutes. And David, I must say I'm very happy. Not a single technical interruption here. Skype worked well for us. This is the third time that we have attempted to do the program. The sound quality appears to be pretty good. Of course, David, you have the information for the archives where you can retrieve the program, right?
Yeah. Where exactly can we retrieve the archives for your listeners as well?
The archives?
Where, the online? Where can we find... Once you've got it archived, where can we find the link?
Okay, here it is. The name. It's on a separate website, separate from Free Radio Santa Cruz, and it's called RadioForAll.net. That's radio, RADIO, and then the numerical character for all.net. RadioForAll.net. www, of course, preceding that. And you'll see a pretty self-explanatory page with various titles of the most recently archived shows. This website is one of those, frankly, liberal leftist labors of love where people have volunteered for many years to keep it up, to keep it going. And many people submit their material. Just type into the search box Mideast Migraines or just Mideast. Probably should put the whole name of the show, though. It'll be make it easier to find. And then in this particular case, I'm going to title this something like Interview with David Vickery or David Vickery Interview. So that's how you find out.
Okay.
And it'll include a podcast engine or a way of listening either through direct podcast or through subscribing to an RSS feed, things like that. A couple of ways of listening to the program. And, of course, you're free to record that if you're inclined or know how to do that, or you can just send the information for how to go to a Radio for All to your family and friends, and they can hear it if they're not listening to it now.
And be sure to write to me if I hope anyone who has questions who weren't able to phone in, they can absolutely write to me
and give us that
David Vickery. David Vickery, 2013@ymail.com. I'll answer any questions you might have.
Ymail.com.
I hope Jane is out there.
You did say ymail.com. It's not ymail.net?
No, .com.
Okay. David Vickery David Vickery.2013. Or that's 2013. David Victor Vickery, V-I-C-K-E-R-Y, 2013 at ymail.com. And Ymail, yes, of course, is the letter Y, M-A-I-L. David Vickery, .2013@ymail.com. That's David's personal email address. And you might not get a whole lot of messages just from the airing of this show, but as the expansion of the awareness of this interview gets out between the two of us, between your contacts and my contacts, you may get more emails. Mm-hmm. And okay,
that's if I don't get droned. Hey, Ren.
Yeah.
That's if I don't get droned. That's if I don't get droned.
Yeah, don't get droned. That'll wreck your whole day. Okay, I'm trying desperately to think of anything else. I hope to see you to see your posts in under Amazon. There are a few more. Have you noticed recently that the Hasbara, the pro-Israel Hasbara, is basically disappeared now on the reviews?
It has died off, and there have been some very good and positive reviews of Goliath.
Yes, there have been many more very positive reviews. I think between the two of us, we've pretty much beaten down the Hasbara trolls, and I mean that sincerely. I think I'm guessing that. The sanity that you and I have tried to contribute to those posts have pretty much put things into proper perspective, and people who otherwise may have been inclined to to diss Blumenthal's work have just kind of given up, or maybe they ran out of steam anyway. It's possible that their numbers just dwindled down and they had to get that out of their system, and that's that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Max Blumenthal is someone I very much admire. He's very brave. It's very dangerous, you know. What he has written is very— Goliath is a very dangerous book.
Yes, and it's one thing for literary giants in my mind like Ilan Pape, who was a Zionist in his very earliest days, to have come out and so given such detailed descriptions to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. It's one thing for him as a Jewish Israeli who cannot even live in Israel anymore, or for Miko Peled, who is another Israeli Jew who is living in San Diego now. My guess is they won't let him back in anymore. But for a Jewish American to come into Israel and make and produce such a work as this, it's astounding. It's very admirable that he was able to do that and live with so much criticism. On Saturday, by the way, David, you know, I just finished the reading of Goliath last 2 days ago. It took 6 months, but I finally completed it. And those episodes are all at radioforall.net. And before I begin the next book, the title I'm withholding for the time being, in a couple of weeks I'm going to do a sort of sum up of the reading of Blumenthal's book, and I'll probably play one or two interviews with Max Blumenthal, and which I've already played on this program, but I'll probably replay those. So anyway, again, David, listen, I sure hope one day to have the pleasure of meeting you personally. And I'll be in touch if by any chance I come across Morocco Way, and I'll keep in touch with you one way or another, my friend.
Well, I hope you will recommend to your listeners that they come to Morocco on holiday.
On holiday.
It's probably the best country. It's the only best country I can think of where Americans can witness Muslims going about their daily lives. It's absolutely laid back. The biggest price, the biggest part of the expense is the flight. Once you get here, everything's really cheap. Another reason I live here.
I kind of suspected that had something to do with it.
Yeah, I just live on my pension. I just live on my retirement pension. I pay just about, at the present exchange rate, I pay about $139 a month for a one-bedroom apartment, and it's nice.
Okay, Mr. Vickery, thanks so much, and I'll see you on the Amazon pages, as they say.
Okay. Okay, bye. It's been fun.
It's been fun. Thank you so much for the interview, and thank you for hanging in there with me through all the other trials and tribulations we've had. Goodbye okay. Now.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. And we're bleep our way out of the interview. That was an interview with Mr. David James Vickery, a Canadian by birth, who lives in Tarodot, Morocco, among Muslim Arabs. And even though we did not advertise this successful airing of the interview, airing and completion of the interview, we did. I did do some advertisement, some promotion of the fact that the interview was going to take place on two previous cases where the interview did not take place. So one way or another, I hope the word gets around. Thanks for joining me. I'm Ren Tawil, and this is the end of Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, May 5th. Talk with you again next Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and of course, on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, next and every Saturday at 11 a.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you.